Okay, let's take our places, settle down. What? Shh. Okay, does anybody have any questions or thoughts from last Thursday's lecture? I have a few observations, but if you have any questions about the talk last Thursday, please let me know. I just wanted to review one more time the course requirements. Students have a certain number of courses they need to take or submit reviews, and if those reviews are not submitted by the end of the quarter, then the requirements aren't met, and it's an incomplete. So please make sure you get those in, because I don't want to give an incomplete to anybody. So if you have any questions, or please contact me after class. So on Thursday, we'll have our midterm project presentations, and the two groups who I haven't talked to yet, I have two positions, the third and fourth, open, so let me know which ones you want to take so I can schedule those. The teams will be getting 15 minutes each. That includes questions and setup. And people who are attending in the classroom will be providing reviews and comments, both to the team and written comments as well. And talked about preferences. And students who are working on individual projects need to contact me if they haven't done so yet about giving their presentations, which will be done outside of class any time after Thursday. So Friday and any time next week would be good. So you need to send me your available times, and I'll see if there's any overlap so I can have multiple students give presentations during one time slot. And as I mentioned, I won't keep you for more than an hour at a time. Oh, I have a funny video to show. Here it is. This was done for April Fool's last year. You like that. So the TechSci robot, they didn't go over that much in the tour, but that's a robot that doesn't have any arms, and it has internet access and mobility, and it has a big screen on the front so that person in one place can have a telepresence on another place through this this robot. So that's new. I want to talk a little bit about Thursday's lecture because I don't think Dr. Steele really talked about some basics. He talked about people with aphasia, and people know aphasia is a brain disorder, and people with aphasia, and there's a range of symptoms, but most of them cannot understand spoken speech and cannot speak themselves. They can't find the words and speak them. So this photo is sort of apropos that that when they're listening to you, it sounds like you're speaking Martian, and they just can't find the words to speak in English. But they know what things are, and they can't read text either. But interestingly, they certainly remember people and, you know, objects and icons. They know what those are. So if they see a picture of a glass of water, they know that it's a glass of water, and they know what to do with it. But they just can't verbalize the words. But they can understand numbers, money, and time. So if you talk to them about those things, that they'll understand it. And Lingraphica is the device that Dr. Steele was talking about. And the reason that it's important is that it enables people with aphasia to find the words that they're trying to find in their brain. So, and it does it through, you know, the animation and icons. The verbs, which he didn't show, are actually animated. So if you wanted to select a verb, you know, drink, it will actually animate a little stick figure. So that's very... So you can make sure that you pick the right verb. Putting a bunch of these icons together, you can construct graphic sentences. And the sentences, the graphics are decoded below in English. And optionally, you can have it speak those verbally with a speech synthesizer. So it becomes a communication aid for people with aphasia. But more importantly, as Dr. Steele said, you can see lips mouthing words, and you can use it to retrain your own speech and communicate. And in many cases, people have relearned to speak using this device, which is like a huge thing. In addition, the device, which is, you know, basically software on a Mac, can track its use. And as you saw with the Smalltalk application, which runs on an iPhone, you can actually pull down the icons then that you want to use in much the same way you pull down music in iTunes. This works pretty much in the same way. You pull down icons to have your communication portable. So it's actually a pretty impressive piece of technology that's been around for over 10 years now. I want to talk just a little bit about labels, and I've been thinking about this for a while, and especially during Elna Time's talk about seniors. And there's a whole list of things that labels for senior citizens. I saw an article that I passed around to you that talked about the graying population, and I think some of us physically can identify with that. And here's some other terms. But, you know, anytime you label somebody, you actually, you know, describe them in some way. And sometimes these descriptions can be negative or positive. And so you got to be careful when you label a person using a certain set of words that you're not, you know, putting them down. So there's, you know, there's good words and there's good labels and there's bad labels. So... And here's the same thing for perhaps some students. And you see there's good things and bad things, and there's actually an intersection here between seniors and seniors. So which of these do you think are positive terms, and which do you think are negative? How would you like to be referred to if it isn't by your name? What group do you belong to? What would be your preference for how to call people? Some of them are sort of neutral to me, like college students, but a lot of them have, you know, negative connotations. Anybody have any thoughts on this? Darnell, I can see you're thinking. Yeah. Well.
Because you have college students post high school.
Right. I mean, you can do all sorts of funny things like that. You're saying you're past this point, but before this other point in your life. You're not what? Juveniles? Okay. That's not a personal reflection, I hope.
That's how we see, always see those two words together.
Yeah, right.
And I'd imagine few people in this class could be accurately described as kids, children, or teenagers.
Yeah, but you know, maybe to your parents, you know, you're their kid.
So, teenagers more specifically.
Yeah, but you know, so it depends, I guess, you know, who's doing the labeling. Right, if your parents are doing the labeling and they say, well, you know, here's my kid, that's their label for you at that time.
Be post-college and still be pre-employable.
that's a very real situation, apparently. Okay, but, you know, this is just something to think about when you talk about, you know, people with, you know, with other disabilities as well. I mean, you can say something that can be really negative, and you may not, you know, think it's negative, but you really got to be careful, you know, how you say things. Oh, this is interesting. So if you're working on a device that would be useful for senior citizens, and there happen to be no senior citizens around that you can talk to, or maybe your skills in communicating with senior citizens are very poor, then you do something like this. You develop a suit that makes you feel like a senior citizen. So it's a suit, a bulky suit with all sorts of restraints and on it, and a visor that affects your vision, and knee pads that discourage bending, plastic shoes with uneven foam pads so to throw you off the center of gravity, a lot of gloves to make you feel like you have all thumbs. So, you know, with this device, then, you know, you become, you know, you're the senior citizen, the older adult that you're designing something for. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Well, yeah, it's hard to verify, to validate what that, you know, what that actually does. But it seems sort of funny that instead of talking to people with who are a bit older, that they went through the trouble of generating a whole suit like this. I guess, you know, this could provide empathy for you know, folks to make you feel better about, or give you a sense about what it might be to what will happen to you when you grow older. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So this was actually from an article in the New York Times. So today Peter's going to talk, and this marks his fifth consecutive year talking to the class. And there'll be an opportunity to have dinner with a bunch of us afterwards. And so if I can get a count after class of how many people want to go over to Max's in Stanford, please let me know so we can have somebody go over there, perhaps Bernie, and reserve a table. So let me know. So let me get my... Peter just flew in this morning, and boy, are his arms tired. I had to do that. Peter is a rehab engineer who sustained a spinal cord injury in 1975 in a climbing accident at the Air Force Academy. You can pull that table over. Continued his education here at Stanford, where he began applying engineering design principles to overcome daily hurdles faced by people with disabilities. In 1981, he founded his company, Beneficial Designs, an engineering firm dedicated to designing, developing, and testing assistive technologies. And in that role, his accomplishments were the first wheelchair-compatible monoski with a shock absorber. I'm sure he'll show some of that stuff. He worked with wheelchair standards. He developed a lot of seating system for wheelchairs, and also is creating a system to assess trails that will improve access to outdoor trails for people of all abilities. Peter's the founder of Beneficial Designs, and he spends most of his time traveling, like today, and traveling throughout the world, attending meetings and presenting his work. He's a pilot and an avid monoskier. So, Peter, I want to turn the microphone over to you, and if you want, I can use this device that will advance slides for you. Can I plug that in? It normally would work the first time. Oh, sorry. Well, maybe not. Okay. Let me give you the microphone. Yep.
So, let's welcome Peter to Stanford. Once again. Here's a laser pointer on here.
All right. Thank you guys very much. It's an honor to come back here. It's an honor to have a couple special people here, too, that have helped our work at Beneficial Designs. Thomas up here going to show us some work that he started. He's going to get to see what happened with what he started. And Arna, I want to thank Arna for coming. When I started at Stanford and showed up in the university, knew I was coming in a wheelchair, but I think I was the first student in a wheelchair to live on campus, and I couldn't get into the bathroom in my dormitory or into the shower, and I was like, this is bizarre. You know, we gave him the dimensions, we told him how wide it was, you know, and gave all the dimensions and everything, and I just remember, you know, spending a lot of time talking to people and trying to help them. You know, well, what should we do? You know, why don't we just take this wall out here, and we could knock this curb out here, and then I could get in the shower. And Arna built the photo club, the original photo club at Stanford, and I showed up at the meeting, and it's like, well, it's not accessible. And within 20 minutes, he's ripping things out and rebuilding things and changing walls, and so. He was a big encouragement to know that you really can just sort of change anything you want. It doesn't really matter what it's supposed to be like. And for 20 years, Arna supported the technical part of our work at Beneficial Designs when we were in Santa Cruz. Thanks for being here, Arna. I'm going to first just give you a little bit of background. I want to back up. You talked about this language thing. And I'm a big proponent of talking about the person first with the impairment. According to the new World Health Organization definitions of disability and handicap and all these words, if you have a disability, that actually means that you have an impairment that's significant enough that you aren't able to participate in life activities. So if that means, like, if I couldn't participate in a class in school, that would be a disability because I'm not able to participate. But the concept is to focus on the person first with the impairment or the limitation. So my impairment is I have a mobility impairment. I have a lot of other impairments related to spinal cord injury. But people have, you know, as we get older, we have visual impairments, hearing impairments, sensory impairments, and so I focus on the person first. Dave's motioning that he's already giving you that lecture. So I broke my back when I was in college in my second year in Colorado at the Air Force Academy, and got to come here as part of my voc rehab to finish school, and it was quite a blessing. I basically didn't really have a clue what kind of engineering I was going to do. I knew I was going to design airplanes and do aerospace things and be a navigator on a B-1 bomber that was experimental at the time. And fortunately, I had a great advisor, Dr. DeBray, who's here. I think I really kind of got redirected to sort of use my circumstances to do things that I was trying to do that I couldn't do, because technology and equipment didn't exist for me to be able to do those things. And the path that I was on to be the navigator on the B-1 would have been a short one. Most of them crashed in Nevada, all the early ones. They were trying to fly too fast, too close to the ground. And in fact, I met a rancher a couple years ago up in Nevada where I live that actually helped bury one in the middle of the night so the satellites wouldn't see it. So I'm pretty thankful that I got redirected on the path that I'm on. So let me take you through a little journey of that path. I started Beneficial Designs because my very first student project, I couldn't find anyone to actually build it and get it out there. And so that's why Beneficial Designs started. I took my $500 prize money and opened the bank account for Beneficial Designs for the student design competition that I had won. So I'm going to take you on a little bit of a tour. Our company's mission statement is that we do basically sort of research, design, and education to allow all people to participate in all aspects of life. And this is where I'm supposed to switch and give you a little quick tour of our company here. So this is our virtual tour. This guy's an electronics designer, software writer, programmer. Those are all technical support. This gal manages our office. She's a photography major. We have a series of high school and college students that come in on their first jobs just to get experience working. This is Jeremy. This guy's a Trails designer, constructor, spends most of his time outside measuring trails with our sensor equipment that he's got there. He has a sensor box that's measuring the trails. We have a wheelchair test lab up in Nevada, and this is Steven. He's calibrating one of the test dummies. We have lots and lots and lots of stuff. Arnold will probably recognize half that stuff in the picture. And electronics work areas. We sell a lot of the materials that we've written, and we have library and just kind of a typical office. We have probably 100 wheelchairs of different types there. We have a pretty open office environment. This is a machine that picks up and drops wheelchairs for impact testing them. You pick it up like 7,000 times and drop it. This is another machine that we built with drums, and we put the wheelchair on it, and the wheelchair drives the drums over the slats. We do that a couple hundred thousand times, try to see where it's going to break. We have tilt platforms that we tip them over with, lots and lots of parts. We can machine parts, we can bead blast them and powder coat them and fabricate prototypes. So all the basic mill and milling machine. So this is a power drum machine. We put the manual wheelchair on, and the machine drives it. We have to design and build these machines. There aren't any manufacturers that make this stuff. So we have a clinical lab. Sometimes when we're developing our products, we have to test the device with human subjects. And so we have to have that mean something, we have to characterize the subject. So we do physiological testing on the people at different work levels to determine their peak, you know, energy output and stuff. And then we know when we test something where we're operating on that person's fitness level, their half capacity or 80% capacity or whatever. We lots of wheelchairs. We calibrate our test dummies. This is a chair that we put our simple test dummies in. We tip them forward and backward and get the balance angle front and rear. We can adjust the center of mass of all our test dummies for safety. And that's a trail gate barrier there that we use to keep motorcycles off trails that we've designed. So we have a half canoe on a motor rocking back and forth so we can test people with our new canoe and paddling seat to verify that it quantitatively improves people's function when they're paddling. And that's our giant test ramp. This is in the back of the airplane hangar, actually. This is where we drive the wheelchairs down full speed, and then we shut the power off, and they'll make sure they don't fall over forward, and we drive them down backwards full speed and shut the power off, make sure they won't fall over backwards, and do all sorts of maneuvers that people are going to eventually do out there. We do turns on the slope, make sure they don't fall over sideways. So we do a lot of wheelchair testing for the manufacturers and redesign of their wheelchairs as well. Put that presentation away. So, let's see. Go back to this one real quick. Whoops. Part of the work that we do at Beneficial Designs is we design consumer products that are focused on thinking about people with special needs, with different kinds of impairments. We've done product development and developed ways of assessing products and also try to incorporate universal design into products. And in the product development area, one thing that we do sometimes is we try to look at mainstream products and how they can be designed better so that more people can use them, so you don't have to design a special product for someone that has the impairment. We look for opportunities for universal design in consumer products. Then when we have to design something different, I could kind of call it an adaptive product or adaptive design, we're creating activities that technologies that are what I would call personal, like my wheelchair, Hans's wheelchair is one of my fellow wheelchair pilots over here, glider pilot. We're wearing our wheelchair. That's a part of us, just like you wear your glasses or your clothes. That technology is personal. You use it for everything that you do versus things that are designed for specific activities, like a bicycle or a car is for a specific thing to move fast because we can't run 60 miles an hour, so we get in a car and we go there that way. So let me show you some of our projects that are related to product design. And so I'll just go through a series of them and give you a little overview of some projects. These are past projects. So this is my actual first project, my student design project. We'll have you here at Stanford, and Dr. DeBray arranged for us to test it up at Alpine Meadows the first time, shut down the ski lift and made sure we can get on and off safely and everything. So this started a whole new sport. I'll never forget the term in, you know, design review. Some professors actually scratching their heads go, who's going to want to do something like this? And so it's a Paralympic sport now. Hand bikes, this is Doug Schwant, some of you know. Now, Doug, this is a project that he and some other, this was a student project I supervised at Stanford. I wanted to ride a bike, but have it tilt just like a regular bicycle, like, you know, lean and steer. So this had little training wheels, and as soon as you got pedaled, you just pull them up, and now you're a two-wheeled bicycle. This is the monoski that we started designing these in about 1985, and I raced on the U.S. Disabled Ski Team for 7 years, and we put shock absorbers in them. I built the first ones with shock absorbers and molded seating and a latch so you could lock and get on and off a chairlift and all the, you know, the details that you need to go skiing if you're in a wheelchair. And so this is a Paralympic sport now, and there are about 5 companies around the world, and we have standards for the equipment, and we test the equipment, and you can go 50, 60, 70 miles an hour on these things. This is a I don't have any back muscles. So if I lean forward, unless I push myself up with my hands, I can't sit up. So this is a orthotic spring assist. I'm wearing a chest harness around my upper body, and then on my seat there's a little fishing rod ferrule, and there's just a fiberglass, just like a fishing rod, spring rod, that goes up through a metal tube on my back. So any direction that I bend, it helps pull me back up into position. I have the stomach muscles to pull forward. So people are using this kind of thing for tennis and all sorts of wheelchair sports. This is a dynamic cross-country ski that I had a series of design groups at Montana State work on this, and finally I just built it on my own. They weren't working out too well. So it articulates, it tips forward and backward. There it's forward and there it's back. So it gives you a little increased range of motion and gives you kind of a kick, you know, like a kick and a glide, just like you would have as a cross-country skier. This is a PAX back that's on my wheelchair. It makes me sit an inch and a half taller. So it's something I can just reach back and tighten up, and then I'm sitting really tall where I can release it and kind of sit back in my chair. Now, the only time I want to sit back is when I'm going downhill, because if I'm sitting upright, I'm going to fall forward. Remember, I don't have any back muscles, so I'm going down the hill, I'm going to fall over. So when I want to lean back, I can lean back. So it's a company in England that's going to get this back on the market again. These are the little wheels, the extra wheels under my chair. Have anybody traveled and seen these little straight-back dolly things that they use to load people onto airplanes that can't walk? Talk about humiliating. They tip you back like you're a bunch of cases of beer or something and roll you down the aisle and then park it, and then you transfer into the seat. Well, I've designed these extra little wheels, and now one of the manufacturers is making them so that you can order them with your wheelchair, and then you just take your big wheels off in the galley of the plane and go down the aisle and get to the seat on your plane with a little more dignity. It's one of those computer balance chairs I modified. Yeah. Yep. This one? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can't drive anymore once you do the arm stroke. The airline seats all have arms. So occasionally, if there's a big galley through a 747 or something, I'm grabbing onto beverage carts and flight attendants and whoever else is there to get through. But yeah, you can't push yourself around very well without those wheels on. I like that balance concept, so I built this wheelchair where you could sit in that posture, forward posture at the desk, rearward posture when you're wheeling around. This is the molded seat that I'm sitting on. That's the actual seat cushion that I'm sitting on, and I made a plaster mold of me and carved that with a piece of rigid foam into the soft foam. So it's a customized seat. We developed a whole standards work to test wheelchair seat cushions. So this is a gel butt with a skeleton side of it. So we can push that into the seat cushion, and we can measure the pressures and the envelopment and how well it works. And our company designed a lot of the test procedures that are now being used internationally to test seat cushions. And in fact, the guy that worked with our company for 7-8 years, Alan Siegman, he's taken that whole part of our company now, and he does the seat cushion testing for the West Coast of the United States and does just seat cushion testing and design work, and we focus on the wheelchairs. Yeah. Plaster, yeah. You wrap yourself in plaster bandages and then wait till they dry, but not too dry. And then you cut them off, and the same way you make a cast, basically, yeah. And then you take that mold and you fill it up with plaster. So if you want to make something fit really well on any part of your body, you can buy these bandages that you just put them in a pail of water, and then you get them all wet, and then you unroll it, and you just drape them over that part of your body, and then they get real warm as they start to kick off, and then you peel it off before it gets hard, and then you've got this shape of your body, and you can fill it with plaster, and then you can make something to fit on that plaster part. This is a thing called the hip grip that Jamie Noon and Alan designed. It's a spring-loaded support. It's kind of like the thing in my back, the spring rod in the back, only this is for the whole pelvis. It holds the whole pelvis to help somebody. So somebody that has cerebral palsy or something that spasms a lot, it'll help them get back into the posture that they want to be in. These are the flex rims. These are these hand rims on my wheelchair. The hand rim is attached to the wheel with a thin layer of rubber, urethane rubber. So when I push, I just push into that rubber, and I don't have to grip anymore. I don't have to squeeze my hands because this hand doesn't squeeze so well anymore. It's squeezed too much for 35 years. So now I just push my hand into that, and it works. This is another concept that's a sleeve over the hand rim. And there's plastic glides in there that let it slide, but when you squeeze, the rubber connects to the hand rim inside. This is the canoe seat project that we worked on, and this is a product now that's available from Chosen Valley Canoe Accessories, and it supports the pelvis and the spine to do canoeing and kayaking and water sports. And I just threw in a couple slides that show how we sort of we evaluate things. So like this guy's sitting in a canoe that's on rollers, and we tip it, and we see, well, how far can he tip in the standard seat that comes with the canoe, and how far can he tip with the seat that we've designed? And so we quantify everything that we've created to show it's, you know, lets you tip 250% more than you can tip without it. And then we do safety testing. So okay, well, if we tip it over in the water, can he still get out of it and not drown upside down in the canoe? So we do safety testing, and so there they're doing another measurement with the canoe. This is the actual seat that's on the market now that it's commercially available. So it's got different pieces that you add depending upon the level of function that the person has or doesn't have, depending on the disability. We've also designed a process for measuring trails for accessibility called the Universal Trail Assessment Process, and then a high-efficiency trail assessment process, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. This is a device we designed to measure how firm and stable surfaces are. So we want to measure playgrounds, for example, to make sure they're soft enough to pass a head impact test for the kids falling off the equipment, but also firm and stable enough that when we go on there in a wheelchair, we're not just going to sink in the shredded rubber and be stuck there. So we've created software for processing data on trails. This is what the software looks like. We create basically what looks like a food facts label for trails on the typical and the maximum grades and the crawl slopes and the obstructions. And we put these trail access information strips on signposts out on the trails. We have a website where you can go see trails that have this information measured. And then we've been working on trail access barriers, which I think I showed you a picture of earlier. All right, I'm going to go back to this presentation. So sometimes what we do is that's all the product design stuff, and all of our projects aren't in there. But the next category of stuff that we do is developing ways to measure and test things in terms of to be able to compare products and to see how well they're working. So to do that, we do wheelchair testing, and you saw some of the pictures there. We do the seat cushion testing. You saw the gel butt. We're working on single rider golf cars now, which are like golf cars for one person, and you can swivel your seat, you know, take your shot and turn your seat back and drive. We're working on how to test playgrounds for accessibility using that equipment that you saw in the picture there. That's that device you saw. We're working on an ASTM standard for that. We're also working on the usability of consumer products by people with cognitive impairments. So that may seem like an interesting concept. So you say, well, what does that mean? basically we're trying to increase the availability of technology for people that have various kinds of cognitive impairments. And the technologies that we're looking at are simple consumer products from like cameras, cell phones, fire extinguishers, fire alarms, alarm clocks, stoves. And when we think of somebody that has a cognitive impairment, we're talking about difficulties maybe with learning, processing, remembering. I think I'm fortunate for our senator that got shot, but I mean, the country is becoming extremely aware of what it actually is going to take to recover from a head injury, because we're getting to watch it live on television and see how the brain can reorganize itself to regain control of the body. And there's a lot of different reasons people have cognitive impairments, and people get older and they have Alzheimer's and various diseases that cause cognitive impairment. I had a traumatic brain injury when I fell 165 feet and my helmet was split open. So I have memory issues. And we're looking at this problem. And just to give an example of sort of how we're looking at it, for example, we want to be able to take a product and sort of rate it for the level of cognitive function. You sort of give it a cognitive rating so that I could choose a simpler product versus a more complex product. So here's, you know, the simpler camera versus the more complex camera with 24 buttons and levers and knobs and adjustments on it. So you all understand that there's differences between products, and you choose products along that spectrum for various reasons. But the thing that we've gotten the feedback on the most are these four things, actually, is our first things that we need to attack. Cell phones, transportation, issues of understanding schedules and wayfinding, and microwaves and fire extinguishers. So, for example, on a phone or something, the distance between the keys might be real important for someone's impairment in terms of being able to actually hit the right button. The force required to press the key might be an important thing. So we can develop simple ways to measure these things, and we could allow products to be compared. How long do you have to be able to hold the button to turn it on or off? Is that adjustable? Simple kinds of things. How many steps do you have to go through on your phone to call somebody in your contacts list? For somebody with a cognitive impairment, it might not be acceptable to go more than two steps or something. Or how many steps is it going to take to add a new number? Error recovery. Can you back up out of where you were easily? Is it clear how you do that? Prompting options. Can we customize those? So what we're doing is we're coming up with a list of objectable, measurable criteria to evaluate consumer products. We've got over 200 items on the list so far. And big companies are really interested in what we're doing. Some of them got very upset and nervous and excited when they first heard about it. And most of them are starting to get excited about what we're doing here. For example, the input mechanism is, does this device allow just one of these ways of inputting to it, or can you use multiple ways of inputting to it? Can I use eye tracking device to control this thing, or could I use a button, or could I use voice control? So understanding what kind of input devices something would accept is an important thing, or how you're going to operate and navigate the software. Or how am I going to operate the buttons and switches that are on it? So that's one area that we're looking at in terms of products. Now I'm going to talk about not just products, but another part of what our company does is we look at how to redesign the built environment to be more usable by a broad range of people. And we've worked on writing the standards for ski areas. And how do you do something like that? Well, you bring a bunch of experts together, and you have a meeting, and you start drafting out, what are the areas that we need to cover in this draft guideline. And we organized a series of 7 or 8 or 9 meetings, and by the time we got done, we had a document that we published, and then the Forest Service took it, adapted it, rewrote it, and it's on their website. It's their, it's the Forest Service guidelines. 95% of all ski areas are on Forest Service land. So that's how a concept for let's try to make things more accessible gets to becoming law, is a federal agency finally says, hey, we like what you did there. We're going to take that, and we're going to make that part of our requirements for operating a ski area on our public land. Amusement parks. Our company helps design rides. I get paid to go to Orlando and ride rides. I go down there, we figure out, okay, how are people going to make the transfer? Can we get a wheelchair onto this ride? How are we going to get out? How are we going to get in? It's only 42 seconds. How are we going to do that? Is it going to work? Johnson Space Center, the new space shuttle simulator, has an accessible ride position. Almost every roller coaster has an accessible ride position that's easier to get into. They've made a reasonable accommodation. One ride, this new Rock and Roller Coaster, has anybody been on the Rock and Roller roller coaster, the one that goes straight up? That was a challenging roller coaster because it's a German design. The only thing that holds you is this thing that comes around here, your body, your legs, nothing else is held onto. And so to get into it is very difficult. So we had to design a special transfer wheelchair that would plug into this ride and allow you to, so you get in this special chair and then they plug you into the ride, and you get into the ride because you only got 42 seconds before it leaves. So we work on amusement park rides. We're going to look at sidewalk environments and outdoor recreation trails. We also do the testing on the playground surfaces. We have test beds at our company. We fill up the test bed with the playground surface following the instructions, and we put a wheelchair on there with strain gauges on the wheels, and we measure the work to roll across that surface. And we make sure that the work is less than rolling up a standard ramp. That's how we determine if it's accessible. I'm going to look at trails for a second, and also let's take a pause. You guys like trails, or are you more interested in sidewalks? Trails, okay. Okay, so we'll go to trails. Oops. One's here somewhere. Here it is. There's a lot of slides in there. Oops. That didn't work. Oh, I clicked the wrong thing. Here we go. So this is the view on the other side of the Sierras, by the way, where we live in Nevada. What makes a trail accessible? Well, accessibility is different to different things. If you're on an OHV, it's got to be 4 feet wide. If you're on a horse, it's got to be 10 foot clear. If you're in a wheelchair, it's something else. So we decided we needed to look at the characteristics of the trail to communicate information about the trail so people could determine if it's accessible to them. We used the rotational penetrometer to see how firm and stable the surface is. For a wheelchair user, the firmness and stability of the surface is the most important factor. If it's a soft surface, it doesn't matter how flat it is or how wide it is or whatever, I'm not going to get very far on it. I'm just going to be literally stuck in the sand. So we look at how to measure things. So one of the things we're looking at are all the elements in a campsite, the tables, the picnic tables, the campfire rings, the cooking grills. Picnic table, it's pretty easy. If they put in a longer top on it and it's the right height, you can get under it and use it. You'd think it wouldn't be that hard to follow, but we are developing an assessment process to do this. 80% of the manufacturers that say they make picnic tables that are accessible don't meet the guidelines. The guidelines, by the way, were just signed into legislation last summer, and they go into effect in March of 2012 by our president just signed it. So all the guidelines that I've been working on for 20 years on outdoor recreation access are about to finally become law. So now everyone will need to build things more accessible. So this is my hiking shoes. If I go on a trip somewhere and I want to take my hiking shoes, it's a lot of extra luggage to carry around. We're talking finding a special rental car vehicle to accommodate it. But this has four-wheel disc brakes. I can drive down a flight of stairs. So trails that I wouldn't think of doing in this chair are a piece of cake for this chair. So it's all about the technology and where you're going and knowing where you're going. So our universal trail assessment process systematically measures the grade, the crosslope, the tread width, and the surface of the trail. We use simple tools to make the measurements, smart levels, clinometers, roller wheels. We measure the length, the width, the crosslope, the grade, and surface as we go down the trail. And we've trained over 1,000 people and certified them to do this process. So there's a lot of people running around doing these measurements now, especially since the new accessibility guidelines require you to make these measurements for your trails. So we created software to manage the data and split and copy and do your trails. That's what your data sheet looks like. So we realized we needed to automate this process more. So we created software to keep track of the data and allow you to create reports. And the reports allow you to organize all your features. So the manager is looking at the number of bridges and culverts and riprap and swale, open swales and retaining walls, and they're trying to do depreciation and maintenance schedules and costs. And the rest of us, from the accessibility point of view, we're looking at the typical grades and what they are and how much of this trail is over 14% grade, 2.2%. Hey, we could probably make this one accessible with a little bit of work. So we decided to make this process a little more efficient, so we created a jogging stroller with sensors on it. So laptop computer, sensor box, measures the grade and crosslope, distance, GPS, camera. Okay, so next thing you know, you got a little system that you can use to do this. So now we've already sold a dozen of these things to entities around the country that are using them to systematically go out and measure their entire infrastructure. And hopefully Thomas doesn't cringe here when he sees the software interface coming up. But we can measure urban shared use paths. We can measure neighborhood connector trails. We can measure snow trails. These are the cross-country ski trails up in the Sierras. And they're set tracks. So we've got maps now and signage for all the trails up there. We can do day use parks. We can do backcountry trails. This is the backcountry version of our measurement device. It's basically a roller wheel with all the sensors just on a roller wheel. The operator's got to carry the computer on their forearm like Jeremy does, or in a chest harness. And Arizona has one of these. We also have another version that goes on a ATV, so you're going to measure ATV trails. Now we have guys who want to put it on a mountain bike and measure mountain bike trails. So our software is designed to collect all this information. So there's your work, Thomas. That's how far we got. Can't even remember where we were when you took off for Tunisia or wherever you went to. So we keep track, and we've got this to try to be as visible as possible out in the sunlight. So we've got the numbers to try to pop out. The green ones are the active numbers, and the yellow ones are the last station. And we just keep, the more often you make your measurements, the more accurate your data becomes. And then we've got feedback to tell you, hey, the grade just changed 2%. Stop and take another reading. So it's taking readings as often as you stop, and it takes about a half second for the sensors to stabilize, and then you take another set of readings. Then you stop. Oh, there's a feature. Let's record this embedded rock. We record the length, width, and height of the rock and the remaining tread width, and then we know what that minimum pinch point width is on the trail. The manager knows what kind of resources might need be required to remove the rock. And we would do this for ruts and roots and rocks and picnic tables and bathrooms and all the features that are on a trail. Then our data looks like this. It's in a SQL database. Click on the column, it sorts it. So I can see it's sorted by tread width right now. The minimum tread width is 24 inches. Here we can see the height of our obstructions. The highest obstructions are 3 inches high, so that's not too bad. That's pretty access, high degree of access trail. Then we put the information in different formats. We can put it on the internet, so you can search by state, looking for trails of a specific length that are firm and stable, or a certain width, or less than a certain grade. You can also just choose, I want one goes to a waterfall. I don't care about the access, so I just want to go see waterfalls. So you can choose and then see the results of your search and then get the detailed information about that trail, which would be this what we call trail access information. We put it on these signposts. This one's stuck up on a existing post there, and you walk up to that and get all the details about that trail. We usually put them on these 4x4 wooden posts. We have basically systematically measured everything in northern Nevada and all the parks. And we just got funding from the State Recreation Trails Program to measure all the state parks in Nevada, which is only 12. But we got the support to go do all the trails in all the state parks in our state. So we're going to be doing that starting today, actually. He's on his way down there to start measuring in southern Nevada right now. So narrow trails, colors, and logos go on them. These are the panel maps that we make. This is what they look like up close. The different trails are color-coded, and then you can look in the table and get the actual trail access information for that trail, the width, the grade, cross slope, etc. This is another state. This is one of the state parks in Nevada, and because it's in the summer, it's really bright. It gets hot outside, so we're trying to use cool colors. We're trying to not have white, so dark too much contrast on the signage. So you look at a white sign in the sun, it's kind of blinding your eyes. So again, colored trails. This is a 2x3 foot sign. This one's in a park with baseball fields and all that sort of thing. This one's up at Washoe Lake. Trails going along the shoreline, up into the hills. And this is gas tax money. A portion of the gas tax money comes back to fund recreation trails. It's funding that work. So basically, we're trying to prevent, in some cases, we're trying to create the access by giving people information to know where they can go and can't go. So you don't go somewhere and get frustrated. You know where you can go, and you go. Now, a lot of trails, they're trying to keep the motorcycles out in Nevada and stuff. There's a lot of BLM land where they can ride their motorcycles. This park decided they'd just make a little narrow spot there, and that'll keep the motorcycles and the OHVs off the trail. So we've been designing a trail gate barrier and to allow wheelchair users onto the trails and mobility devices, but keep the motorcycle stuff off. So this is a kissing gate. They don't work very well for wheelchair users. This is a single step. They don't work very well for wheelchair users. This is a bunch of logs. Works really well for wheelchairs. A stile, walk up a ladder and over the other side. That works really well for wheelchairs. This is the culprit. Now, there's tons of trails they're allowed on, but this is just for the trails they're not allowed on. So we just designed this great device that was wider at the bottom, narrow at the top, and we took it to the motorcycle event. Said, okay, guys, show us if you can get through this thing. So we designed a mechanical trail gate barrier that allows mobility devices, but keeps out the motorcycles. Kind of works, but they can unbolt their handlebars and turn them upside down and drag them through. So we also designed an electric system. So we designed an infrared camera with two lenses. One that's focused to count pedestrians going in and out. And that's just using alarm technology. We can count if they're going in or they're going out. And then the second one has got a lens on it, so we can look at a spot that big right at motorcycle engine height. And so that the land managers like that solution. Okay. Okay, back to the main presentation here. Oh, which means we're going to go to the next prison. I guess we got time for a little bit of sidewalk stuff. Show you a little bit of sidewalk stuff. Here we go. So this is a current project that we're working on. And we're using the same jogging stroller to measure the sidewalk environment. Basically, the planners, the engineers, the city guys that build the infrastructure in the city need a way to measure it more efficiently. So our company was contracted to create a design guide on how to design accessible sidewalks. And that's a Federal Highway publication that's on their website. And now the Access Board has been adopting those guidelines to be the requirements for all cities. So 32 states have adopted the guidelines. Now they're trying to figure out how do we begin to go out and measure all this stuff. It's incredibly time-consuming. I'll show you what it looks like to measure it. You go out there with a smart level, and you've got a typical curb ramp. You got to measure the ramp, the grade on the ramp. You got to measure the gutter, the grade on the gutter. You got to measure the grade on the flares. You need to make sure the landing's level. You need to make sure the approaches on the landing are not too much cross slope. So you're kneeling down about 8 times at every one of these. So it's like a workers' comp claim waiting to happen. Then there's like driveway crossings. You guys probably don't think about this unless you've tried out a wheelchair. You go down the sidewalk when they're right along the street, and you get to the driveway crossing, you got to cross this flare, and it's a twisted surface. Wheelchairs have 4 wheels, so that means when you go across a twisted surface, you go from 3 wheels to the other 3 wheels, and in between, you're out of control because one of those rear wheels is off the ground, and you don't have control anymore. So you're basically out in the street. So it's tedious and it's time-consuming. Lots of bending and squatting. Then there's this other issue that a lot of cities are really concerned about, are tripping hazards. The pavement upheaves, trees, sinking sand, all sorts of reasons that the concrete, you know, not enough base, whatever. You use a profile gauge and trace it on your data sheet. There's what it looks like. It's 9/16 of an inch. You need to send the grinding crew out to go grind it away to eliminate the tripping hazard because cities are, a lot of them are getting buried in accidents. People trip on these things. They get hurt. They come to get compensation for their injuries, and they have to pay out the money to deal with it. And so we would like to be able to do that as well. So we've added a laser to the cart to measure the tripping hazard height. And we can say, okay, our threshold is anything over 1/4 inch. And here's one 7 feet down the sidewalk that's 4/10 inch. So we can quickly and get the GPS location and the heights of those tripping hazards. So we did a lot of prototype data collection. Okay, we get to a bus stop. I got to measure the bus stop for accessibility. So the picture shows me set the cart here. So I put the cart there. I hit the enter key. It pulls in the grade and the crossslope. Then it tells me to measure the clear space to see if there is clear space for someone in a mobility device to park there. Then I get the dimensions of the bus stop itself and the setback from the street to make sure the person in a mobility device can get to the bus stop. Sometimes they forget about that when they put them in. And then let's look at a typical bus stop landing. Is it level? Is the bus going to even be able to put the lift down? How about a bench? Does the bench have the right sitting height? Is there a clear space next to the bench? Is the bench height correct? So we're just creating these simple user interface screens to guide people through. Here's a typical curb ramp. This is a diagonal curb ramp where there's sidewalk with one ramp at the corner. Not the best design. It puts you out into the traffic. It's better to have one this way and one this way. Put the device on the ramp. Hit the enter key. Boom. There comes the grade and cross slope into the data table. Okay, up on the landing. Boom. Boom, 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 boom. So like just in a couple minutes, you've got all the grades and cross slopes measured on all the elements, and it's automatically noting which measurements are in compliance or out of compliance as the operator. And now I'm doing my measurements. We're working on a little wireless roller wheel, so we can just roll those out and click those numbers in. And then maybe then there's a driveway crossing, same thing. And then the data for one particular element has all these attributes that come down the left side. And then the different curb ramps are across the top there. And then what we figured out is we can measure these things now in about 20% of the time that it took to measure them manually before. So we think this is, the Federal Highways thinks this is such a good idea that they've funded us for the next phase of the project. They're like, we want this as a product yesterday. Please get it done as quickly as possible. So we're working on the software modules to continue this work. We're working on how we summarize that information and how the GIS people are going to use this. Everybody knows what GIS, geographic information systems are. Since we're taking the GPS location of every feature that we're measuring, it's going to be real easy to take this data that's all in a SQL format with the GPS position and bring it into the GIS software that cities are using to track everything from their sewer layer to their water layer to their electrical layer to their road layer to their parcel layer. They have layers of information about their cities. And so we're planning what the sidewalk layer is going to look like. GIS keeps tracks of things that keeps track of things as points, lines, and spaces. So here's what it looks like when we measure the city. This is a street in Carson City. The squares are curb ramps, and the circles are driveway crossings, just arbitrarily shaped. The green ones are ones that meet the access requirements, and the red ones don't. It's pretty simple, right? So you just turn on this stuff. The planner can see exactly where the problem areas are and can begin to start planning what they're going to do about it. This is what it looks like on top of an aerial image. We were just using a recreation-grade GPS here, and we're within 4 or 5 feet on almost every one of these features. So we're designing symbols because GIS people, like a lot of them, like to have the right symbol for the right thing, not just squares and circles. So we're designing a font library with the symbols to have a true type font that has all the sidewalk symbols in it. And whereas in phase one we just created shape files for a particular point, this is what when you click on the map, if you click on this symbol, this is the attribute data that pops up on the GIS software to show you the attributes of that feature. And then I can say, show me all of these items, show it to me in a table, and then I can order the attributes according to the grade. In this case, the maximum grade on this driveway crossing is 16%. So that's a 16% cross slope that I was having to drive across. So the city took this data that we created and they reconstructed this entire corridor on Washington Street in Carson City, and we're going to go back and remeasure it. So it turns out that shapefiles is sort of like the generic format for putting this type of data in for GIS systems. Geodatabases are like the specific format for the data in Esri software. So we're trying to eliminate the cost of high construction by improving and speeding up the process for planning and design, and trying to eliminate as much reconstruction and demolition as possible by giving them a tool that they can say, we're going to measure this before we pay the contractor and then have it done that way. So let's see what was back on the original presentation. All righty. So the other thing that our company works on is a lot of different standards activities and RESNA. Some of you, Dave, probably already told you what RESNA is. But we work on wheelchair standards, wheelchairs and seating standards, wheelchairs and transportation, mattress overlays. And on the handout, for those that might have to leave, my email address and everything's on the back. So if you if you want to get in touch with me about anything. If there's anything on those handouts that wasn't covered, you're also welcome to shoot an email and we can give you more specific information, because I wasn't possibly going to be able to cover everything that's outlined on the handouts. Thank you for coming. So RESNA is managing the standards for the cognitive technologies. We're also writing standards for emergency evacuation devices. So like when 9/11 happened, there were devices in the stairwells used to drive people down stairways, from as simple as plastic sleds that I skied in, driving people down the stairs, to more complex things with tracks and things that go downstairs in a little more controlled manner. We're working on standards for the single rider golf cars. We have standards for ski lifts, aerial tramways, to have those be accessible, gondolas. We're working on standards for fitness equipment to make all fitness equipment more accessible. And just to show you a couple pictures of the problem, this is a typical seat on a weight machine. It's just a little triangle, and this guy's in a wheelchair. He can barely stay on this machine just to keep from falling off. So we're coming up with minimum seat dimensions for fitness equipment. We're trying to provide for removability of the seats so you can back in and use some of the equipment in your wheelchair. I went to transfer onto this device, and what I was holding onto was actually the thing that moves when you exercise. So I'm about to just end up upside down on the ground because it's not clear what's solid and what's moving on the device. So handles need to be color contrasted on what's solid and what moves. Treadmills, you need to be able to wrap your fingers around to hold on. If you can't put your fingers around it, you're going to get ejected off the back, possibly. Stepping heights. A lot of people can't step super high, so the step height up onto the treadmill should be less than a standard step height. You should be able to see where the pin is. Color contrast the pin. It shouldn't be a black-on-black situation. You need to be able to see and adjust things. You shouldn't have to use finger dexterity. You can make pins that you can grab without fine motor skills. Minimum starting weights. Look at the control panel on this machine. Okay, that's what looking at it in black and white looks like. See that? That's the color version. And when you make that black and white, there's no contrast on that panel. Somebody that's colorblind can't see a thing on this panel. Here's another panel, and then when you look at that in black and white, you can see the contrast. So the control panels need contrast. There's a specification for contrast for accessibility, but it's not enforced because there's no way to measure it. We're coming up with an NIH project to develop the contrast measurement process that'll allow that to happen. And just in July, our president signed another notice of proposed rulemaking that they're going to start making guidelines for fitness and exercise equipment. So it's like, hello, we're working on some standards on it. So we just submitted the work that's going on with it as an ASTM standard, so that the same committee that's developing the ASTM standards for fitness equipment is also going to develop the ASTM standard for accessibility. And we're requiring and recommended to Department of Justice that 10% of each of these types of equipment be accessible. So that means either one piece, or if there's 20 treadmills, there's going to be two. But there's at least one of each of these devices that has accessibility features built into it. So one of each upper and lower body strength of equipment. These are some of the other issues we're dealing with. How do you safely guide people? We're working on a guidebook to guide people on how to safely use fitness equipment if you're in a wheelchair. It's real easy to tip over in a wheelchair. So that's all my slides.
Peter, it's always great to have you here, and we appreciate your visiting us every year. It's always refreshing to hear from you, and energizing as well. So with that, if you want to talk to Peter, we'll be around for a few minutes, and there's also an opportunity for dinner. Please let me know if you want to join us for dinner
okay.
This evening, and so we can
make reservations, proper reservations. Thank you.
If anybody has questions, I'll be here for a few minutes and be happy to answer your questions, or you can take the handouts and get the email address on there.
Please take the handouts. There is a version of them on the website. Please sign the attendance sheet. We haven't done that yet.
Are you David Bates's? My name is Bate.
Right.
Bate.
Bate.
Yeah. Are your databases accessible to, like,